fabulous. Well, they share everything. So I just want you to hear JD. So please welcome for the first time on platform at Unity of New York, JD Strong.
I roamed the streets of New York one night in June, 16 years ago, deep in the fog of addiction and depression, feeling as if everything that I had attempted to do, I had failed at doing. And I made the greatest mistake of my life that nearly ended my life. And I've learned a ton in the 16 years since that night. And so this morning, what I hope to do is share with you some of those lessons with an eye to how all of us, regardless of what we're facing, can choose to respond differently. So let me give you a little bit of context. June of 2003, I had a lot of successes. I had just signed a contract to sell my apartment in the East Village for a six-figure profit. I had just signed a contract to start teaching at NYU full-time with benefits, only 1 year after finishing my MBA. And I had just finished a six-month volunteer commitment at a small Catholic high school in Western Kansas where I had attended and had grown up, helping them raise $250,000, and for the first time in almost a decade, end up in the black. So I had a lot of awesome stuff going on. And yet, I was hiding the failures. The reason I had to sell the apartment was because I was so far behind in both my mortgage and my maintenance payments that I was about to lose it. And the reason I had accepted the job at NYU was because the job I really wanted to be president and administrator at this small Catholic school in Kansas was not something that was available to me as a gay man, unless I was willing to go deep back into the closet. And my struggle with addiction and depression, I had just earned my third DUI, which meant jail time. And on the trip back to New York City to sign the contract for the apartment, I slipped again with cocaine and did not feel that I would ever get on the other side of those demons. So back to that night, June 11th, 2003. I sat in a bar off Union Square, drinking, chatting up the bartender, making phone calls to people, not I'm in trouble, I need help, but leaving messages for people so that when they heard my voice on their answering machine, they would have a fond memory of me. For two or three days, I had begun to plot what I thought would be my death, and I wanted it to look like an accident, that nobody would have dreamed with all these great things going on that I'd actually chosen to do something self-destructive. And I told the bartender, I'm gonna leave my luggage and my cell phone here. I just need to run to the ATM to get cash to pay you, and I'll be right back. And I never returned. I wandered the streets, I wandered the subways. My first plan had been to stage it and make it look like I tripped and fell in front of a train. And I had a moment of clarity that came from something outside of myself, that I did not need to damage or traumatize other people because of my pain, and that that was not a choice that I should make. So then I decided that I would take a leap from the Brooklyn Bridge. I knew at that point it was now gonna be a visible sign of self-destruction, and I needed to leave a note for my family. And the only way I could conceive of to do that was to go to the ATM machine that I had promised the bartender I was headed to. And instead of taking out money, because I was extremely overdrawn, like it was complete fiction that there was any money coming to me out of that machine, on the back of deposit slips, I wrote my suicide note. And I folded it in with a note that said, please call my father at this number so that he knows what happened. And I deposited those slips into my account. There's some sort of metaphor about a bankrupt life and a bankrupt ATM machine being where I chose to put my last note to the world. And then I wandered what I thought was to the Brooklyn Bridge. I found out about 9 months later, it was actually the Manhattan Bridge. Couldn't even get that part right. Went up to the edge, about in the center, and I remember in that moment praying not to be saved, but to be forgiven for what I was about to do. And I looked up at the fence and down at the water. Climbed up and I got scared and I climbed back down and was in the fetal position on the edge of the wall. And then I said, this is it. And I climbed up and I leapt. Somewhere in midair, I lost consciousness. The people who rescued me were able to put together later for me what had happened. When you fall from that big of a height, even into water, it's like hitting pavement. I shattered my right arm, broke every rib, punctured my lung, and somewhere underwater, the thought came to me, JD, it doesn't have to end this way. And I came back above water, gasping, floating in and out of consciousness, but I was able to keep myself up with the arm that I hadn't broken. And I floated underneath the Brooklyn Bridge and out into the pathway of the Staten Island Ferry, at least close enough to the Staten Island Ferry that as I started screaming for help, people on the ferry could hear me and tell the ferry boat captain, who could call the Coast Guard, who could send a rescue to find me in the water. They fished me out of the water. They put me on a backboard, not knowing what injuries I had, got me to the shore, got me to an ambulance, got me to Bellevue Hospital. And late on the night of June 11th, or early on the morning of June 12th, began the physical recovery that was necessary because of the damage I had done to myself. Now, the 23 days that I spent in Bellevue were a remarkable transformation. From what I've read in the medical reports that I have access to, when I first came in, I was not only embarrassed, but I was also extremely upset that I had failed. And I did not want to see my family, who flew from Kansas, my older sister from Oklahoma, my father from Kansas, and were at my side. My dad for the entire 23 days I was there, my sister for the first 2 weeks. But I didn't want to see them. I didn't want to admit what had happened. But somewhere in that 23-day stay in Bellevue, my will to live returned. And I found out later that the prayers that my family and friends and total strangers were offering for me were just that. Bring JD's will to live. My final part of my stay in Bellevue was on the psych ward on 20 East. And my father, who at that point was just a few weeks shy of his 80th birthday, he said, if you weren't depressed before you went on to that ward, you would be as you left. I got 1 hour of visitors a day. Dad would show up a few minutes before 7 and leave a few minutes after 8. And I noticed that nobody else had any visitors for the whole week that I was on that ward. And I recognized that people with dual diagnosis, especially those in public facilities without insurance, really have a tougher road to hoe. I was released from Bellevue on the 4th of July and flew from Bellevue, from New York, back to Kansas and checked into rehab at a place called Valley Hope. And then did the traditional 28 days of rehab from drugs and alcohol. And then after that piece was over, I went back to my hometown in Western Kansas where I had to serve a small amount of jail time for the DUI. And then I spent some time in a retreat house, on a silent retreat in Colorado. And by November of 2003, I came back to New York City a very different person. I had been blessed to be able to heal physically, emotionally, legally, spiritually, and I started for the first time in New York City a journey in recovery from both addiction and depression with a fresh, renewed commitment and a fresh set of eyes. And it's really that second phase of recovery, like that first 6 months was important, but it was really what I began to do as I lived in New York City and accepted, amazingly, did not lose my teaching position at NYU. I didn't have to start in September. My contract started me in November. I started teaching at NYU, living far out in Brooklyn on Avenue P. There is really an Avenue P. There's not a Q. That's all made up for Broadway, but there is an Avenue P. And I was an hour on the commute, back and forth between NYU and Brooklyn. But it allowed me to have a life without the trappings of this great East Village apartment and this fabulous life. A very simple, very serene life focused on my own recovery and my own journey. And I put together what I call the dream team. I had a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a therapist, I had a psychiatrist because I was still on antidepressants at that point. I had a spiritual director, one of the pastors for my church, and I had a CPA who was helping me get my finances back in order. And they never met with each other, but the five of them surrounded me with the professional help that I needed to be able to step forward. And for the first 3 years of recovery, I lived a very simple, very quiet life. I didn't date. I stayed away from toxic environments, both physical environments as well as emotional environments that would hurt my psyche. And I began to really rebuild what I wanted my life to look like. You know, in sharing this with you, I am reminded of a quote by one of my favorite Catholic authors, Henry Nouwen. And in his book, The Wounded Healer, he says, "The man who can articulate the movements of his inner life, who can give names to his varied experiences, need no longer be a victim of himself, but is able, slowly and consistently, to remove the obstacles that prevent the spirit from entering. He is able to create space for him whose heart is greater than his, whose eyes see more than his, and whose hands can heal more than his." I began to see that I could live my life as a wounded healer. I didn't have to be my wounds and my injuries, but they could become the platform for which my life could look different. And it was in that journey that I began to understand the analogy of those of us who are recovering from suicide attempts or serious dual diagnosis mental issues. There's an analogy of a brush fire, or metaphor of a brush fire. Now, when we think of a brush fire, there's actually two things that happen in order for the brush fire to exist. First of all, there's the preconditions. There's the dry grass, there's the high wind, there's the brush that has not been burned away. And so there are all of these preconditions. But in and of themselves, those preconditions are not going to cause a brush fire. They are just going to be preconditions. But when you then have a precipitating event, a lightning strike, a cigarette butt thrown out of a window, a campfire that gets out of control, the combination of those precipitating events and those preconditions then makes a flame, a spark, a brush fire, a forest fire possible. And as I began to do that work in those first few years of recovery, I could see that I had preconditions. I had my addiction, alcohol and later drugs. I had my sexual orientation as a gay kid who grew up in a very Catholic town, in a small town in western Kansas, that I then chose to go back to in my mid-30s. I was troubled. I had had at least two prior serious suicide attempts. And I had depression related to 9/11, many of us went through, related to my mother's death, and related to knowing that I had slipped again into my addiction. And then I had the lightning strikes. I had the DUI, I had the foreclosure proceedings, and I had the slip with cocaine. Let me be clear, I had the slip with crack cocaine. And I need to say it that way because there's nothing romantic about crack cocaine. And so those lightning strikes on top of my preconditions set me up for what could have been the end of my life. There was a short article in the New York Post about my attempt, and in there they said, a deranged middle-aged man had survived a leap from the bridge. Middle-aged, really? Like, what had them think that was an adjective they could use about me? But for a long time, I held on to that clipping, and I still hold on to that language because I'm not who the world saw me to be on the night of June 11th. I am somebody very, very different than that. But I am not different just because I say I'm different, as we often do at service. I'm different because I said so and then took the actions to step into that other sort of thing. One of the authors that I really like from Harvard Business School, Amy Cuddy, says, it's not about faking it till you make it, it's faking it till you become it. And I had to step into the action necessary in order to become it. And now, long term, 16 years, just over 16 years after this event, I still have to manage my preconditions. I have to do some things that are additive, like putting water on dry grass or clearing away brush and getting it to the compost bins. I'm in recovery and I still need to go to my meetings on a weekly and on a regular basis. I have to have a sponsor. I am still in therapy. I take my recovery seriously and I take my faith life seriously. As Britt mentioned in the introduction, I am thrilled to be married to a Unity minister and playing the role with no role models of what it means to be the pastor's spouse. Growing up Catholic, I had nobody that was a pastor's spouse that I could look at and see. But I also am still active in my Catholic faith. I am blessed that I have a gay-friendly Catholic parish in Most Holy Redeemer in San Francisco. And we have two churches that envelop us in our sorrows and celebrate with us our joys. And so I have to be conscious and active in my faith life, in my recovery, and then I still have to avoid toxic places. There are family members, there are conversations, there are locations that I just choose not to put myself in. If something is going to make me feel less than, that is not a place that I need to be. And even in my mid-50s, I can end up in a Facebook group that makes me feel like I'm back in the seventh grade, terrified of what the cool kids will think about me. And so I manage my existence so that I can have a life that I richly love. I had no idea that night on the edge of the Mount Manhattan Bridge what future lay ahead of me, that I would get to meet Ken, that I would get to become a dad to not one, not two, but three remarkable kids from remarkably different journeys. Not only did I get to teach at NYU, but then got recruited west to Stanford, where I have taught for just over 12 years. And just this last week, I was offered a leadership position over a program that I treasure the chance to step into even greater responsibility at Stanford. Bought a home with a garden, with a study, with a nursery, earned my doctorate, went to TED, and had the chance to do a TED talk about my recovery from suicide and addiction. It's a 4-minute TED talk that stepping out and doing it was one thing, but then when they put it up online, it's been seen by almost 1.9 million people. It's been translated into 39 different languages, and every month I get a note from somebody somewhere that it made a difference for. I could not have imagined any of that that was going to be possible that night that I was on the bridge. This year, marking the 16th anniversary of my dark night of the soul, I chose to do the overnight walk for suicide prevention. Coincidentally, it was a 16.3 mile walk. And although Ken and the kids knew that I was doing it, I signed up to do it alone. And I saw it as a chance to really reflect and be with my own thoughts as I walked the 16 miles. Again, late one night in June, this time through the streets of San Francisco instead of the streets of New York. And I didn't realize how many of my thoughts would join me on that journey. How many, primarily men, that I knew that I had lost to suicide, classmates, teachers, ex-lovers, former students of mine. I did not realize how meaningful it would be to me at about mile 14 to be connected with, just out of casual conversation, a 16-year-old boy and his mom. And they and I joined together. Like, the last 3 miles were really hard to do, but we kept each other going. And when I got to mile marker 16, and this 16-year-old kid took a picture of me in front of that sign, it was an alignment of my recovery, my journey, and a complete embrace of what's ahead. What is next for me? On the actual anniversary, I got this text from my sister, my older sister, Kathy, who was remarkable in that journey 16 years ago. She said, thinking of you today, very thankful it was the end of a chapter, not the end of a book. And I can see now that it was unnecessary to take the step that I did, and yet necessary to take the steps after that I did. And I want to be real clear as I wrap up here that this is my journey. My journey is not your journey. I share it in an effort for you to draw lessons from it that can support you. And yet, I urge you to hold on to what we have in common and let go of what about my life doesn't resonate or is not in common with where you're at. A definition that I was given early in my recovery was that of surrender. Now, I had always thought of surrender as giving up, waving the white flag, throwing in the towel. But my sponsor, Roger, taught me that surrender is not giving up. It is going over to the side that is winning. In fact, it's more than that. It's putting yourself in the care of those who are winning. That definition of surrender is one that I can align with and get behind. When there's a part of my life that is not working, be it finances, be it work, be it a job that's not fitting, be it a relationship, be it something with Ken and I that we're not on the same page, I look at what is it that I can surrender? Where is it that I can step over and be on the winning side or put myself in the care of people who are winners? And so I invite you to think about where today, this morning, can you surrender? Where can you put yourself in the care of people who are winning? Where can you do stuff that is subtractive? Clear away the dry grass. Clear away the brush. Remove parts of those factors that are preconditions to a fire. And what can you do that's additive? Where you water, where you meditate, where you pray. What is it that you can do that reduces the likelihood of a lightning strike on the dry grass in your life? The Manhattan Bridge was nearly my farewell to this world, but it has become for me the bridge back to life. I merely had to open my eyes and be present to the hope and the possibility that was already around me. What can you create for what you are facing today? I invite you to just reflect on that as we move into meditation and the rest of service. Namaste.
Chosen this very moment in time, to focus on that still power and that still presence that is within us, accessible at all times. We recognize that all the power and all the presence of God that has ever been is right now and right here where we are. As we allow ourselves to breathe freely, to relax any place in the body where there might be tension, loosening our toes, our fingers, allowing our shoulders to drop farther from our ears on each breath. And the beautiful daily word we heard earlier, we were reminded that our spiritual journey began long before our birth. We are on an eternal spiritual journey that leads us continually ever more deeply into an awareness of God's presence, that awareness of oneness. Even when we've not been seeking, God, Spirit, love, light has always been there, has always been present. And as the psalmist asked, where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? No matter how far we think that we have strayed, a renewed awareness of God has always been as near as our next thought. Whenever we felt stuck or lost on the journey, It's the thought of God that brings us back to the path, to our way home. Because wherever we are, God is. We are in the presence and radiating the power of peace right here and now. And in a state of peace, we recognize that there is no condition. There is no condition that can cause us unrest. Peace is in our very breath, flowing. Flowing in my mind and throbbing in my heart. And let us allow ourselves to drop into that space to know, to experience, to remember this peace in the silence. Peace is in my breath. Steady in the presence and the power that God is and that I am. I am always expressing the unifying power of divine love. I uphold the entire world and every being in the world with a steady mind and a steady, ready heart. I am centered in peace, radiating the love of God, feeling that connection to all that is, to each and all that is, to that oneness. And as we begin to return our awareness to the environment around us, may we agree to take into the rest of our day the heavenly spiritualized thoughts from this experience today, from this time of prayer, this time in peace and wisdom. We go forth knowing that where we go, God is. And that we are divinely connected because we are one. And so it is.